Rabbi Novak has presented a gracious, thoughtful, and thought-provoking paper in which he gives richly deserved tribute to our friend Robert George. Early in the paper, Rabbi Novak says that because we have a shared theoretical framework, we can engage in, quote, interfamilial discourse. Well, as I see it, my job as a commentator or a discussant is to stir up a little bit of a family squabble or a little bit of a family ruckus in order to make things interesting. So in the short time I have, I will mostly set aside the important and central agreement between Robert George and Novak and do what I'm supposed to do and which I'm reluctant to do and which goes against my nature. Since, like Robbie George himself, I'm just ironical at heart, I will ferret out the disagreement and try to set that out and argue some. But by arguing, I think, but not for the sake of argument, but because by arguing we can advance, as Rabbi Novak points out, by arguing we can advance and refine our understanding. So according to Rabbi Novak, there is between Robert George and him a practical agreement, but a theoretical divergence. The practical agreement includes, importantly, a practical commitment to the prohibition of the killing of innocent human life at all of its stages. What Rabbi Novak calls a theoretical disagreement, I believe, is actually a disagreement at the level of more general practical propositions. Theory involves is propositions as opposed to ought propositions. And I think the disagreement is located at the general ought propositions. Or one could say it is a disagreement about the account of how we reach more specific moral ought propositions. The disagreement at the level of general practical principles is that Robert George holds that rights are implications of intrinsic human goods and basic moral principles, whereas David Novak holds that the concept of what is morally right is logically prior to the concept of what is good. Roughly, George holds that the good is logically prior to the right. Novak holds that the right is logically prior to the good. According to Robert George, the genuine basic goods of persons, of human persons, ground duties toward those goods. The basic moral principle is that we ought to promote and protect these goods in ourselves and in others, and we ought to choose in a way that is in line with a love of all of these goods, both in ourselves and in others. My right to life, for example, is then actually everyone else's duty to respect my life, the duty of others to not to kill me, the duty of others to take account of my life in their actions that bear on me. Justice consists in acting toward others in a completely reasonable manner, that is, not being deterred from a positive will toward the genuine good of others by feelings of partiality and other emotions. Justice is willing the genuine good of others in a way that is undiminished by feelings of partiality. By contrast, according to David Novak's position, the good indicates only what is in accord with the nature of the claimant and the respondent between whom there is a claim, a claim in justice of the one to respond to the other. For example, the good indicates what is in accord with the nature of a human baby, but that does not show that the baby has a claim on one, say, not to kill her, or a claim on one not to take care of her, or a claim on her to take care of her. Rabbi Novak concludes that, quote, hence these claim rights are the true criteria of justice. Justice as the order of rights is the more basic ethical political term than good or the good, unquote. How Rabbi Novak understands the basis for these logically prior claims of justice is indicated later in his talk, where he says, quote, "The true reason for opposition to abortion is that every human life has the right not to be harmed because he or she is created in the image of God. That means the human creature most uniquely reflects the ultimacy of the Creator God, ultimacy that makes a claim on our respect, minimally on our restraint. When faced by that ultimacy, even when faced by the reflection of that ultimacy, we have no rights, only duties," unquote. My problem with this is that it seems to say that only God is in himself worthy of respect and directly morally inviolable, that created persons are worthy of respect only because of their relationship to God. I do not think that is correct. God has indeed commanded us to pursue and respect the genuine fulfillment of ourselves and our neighbors. But it does not seem to me that the fulfillment of myself and my neighbor is worthy of pursuit only because God has commanded us to pursue them, or even because of their, or only because of their relationship, say the relationship of creature to creator, or of child of God to father. My worry is that grounding the moral ought only in God's command or in God's ultimacy, rather than in the good, may have the illogical implication of reducing the goods other than religion to a merely instrumental status. It was wrong for Cain to kill Abel, not just because God prohibited that. The fact that this was a disobedience of the Creator added to the wrongness of the act, but killing an innocent human being is in itself wrong, and the wrongness is compounded by, but does not just consist in, its also being contrary to God's wise plan. Of course, it may be that in this short analysis, I am inadvertently and unfairly oversimplified Rabbi Novak's position. I am certainly not attributing to him any type of fideism, and I fully realize that his position includes a robust recognition of natural law as distinct from or in addition to divine positive law. But I set out these possible disagreements or worries for the purpose of encouraging discussion, which, as I understand it, is the good or the purpose of a discussant, or at least what a discussant is commanded to do, whichever way you put it. I have a right to do. By the way, that's the first time I've heard myself described as a discussant. Commentator, I don't know. I'm from Texas, and my vocabulary needs enlargement. We suffer from that kind of state constraint. Although I have to add, after Jim Stoner's talk this morning in the discussion about Northeastern liberals, I wanted to say that some of my best friends are Northeastern liberals. Although I'm not sure I'd want one of my daughters to marry them. The first worry is connected to a second concern that I have. Rabbi Novak says of those who choose to kill innocent human beings, quote, "Lethally claiming an innocent human life is like killing a prince when one's true intent, one's real reason, is to kill the king, whose kingship is most directly reflected in the prince who most clearly bears the likeness of the king," unquote. Rabbi Novak suggests that Cain's motive for killing Abel was revenge on God for having favored Abel. He says that, quote, "an assault on a human person is meant to be an assault on God," unquote, and that the real object of assault in abortion is God, who loves this person. I believe Rabbi Novak is right to point out that there is an important connection between how we treat our neighbor and ourselves on the one hand, and our love of or failure to love God on the other hand. But I do not think he is right to say that an assault on a human person is always motivated by revenge or hatred of God. It seems to me that Cain valued his relationship with God as something good, but he began to desire this relationship with God in a disordered manner. He did not simply want to be in harmony and cooperation with God, but he wanted to be the only one who had God's favor. This is pride, a disordered desire for status. He then viewed Abel's gaining favor with God as threatening his status, his being the only one for God, and therefore he hated Abel. It seems to me then that killing Abel was directly motivated by hatred for Abel, which stemmed from a disordered desire for status. This hatred of Abel, another human person, indeed his own brother, is in itself wrong. In itself, it involves a diminishing of one's love for what is genuinely good. This choice involves introducing into one's will a privation, a diminishing of the love and appreciation that our will is capable of, and so it has in it a moral evil, namely a privation in a will. The good, it seems to me, and I agree with Robert George here, the good is able to make a kind of claim on us, the good, the real fulfillment of myself and of others like me, because I see in it a reason for acting. There's some point to acting. If I wake up in the morning, and if I woke up in the morning and I was already perfect, and saw no need to help anyone else, what would I do? Nothing. There wouldn't be any point in doing anything. If I'm already perfect and I don't want to help anybody else out, there's no point to acting. The point to acting is to realize, to fulfill, to bring about the fulfillment of myself or of someone else that I care for. Therefore, my understanding, my apprehending, my intellectually seeing that there's a possible way of realizing or fulfilling myself or of someone else is a reason for acting. And so I see that, well, that is worth pursuing. And so the good then, what my understanding of the good tells me, or is my understanding of a possibility worth bringing about, a possibility that is worthy of bringing about. Choices, then the next step, I think, is I can also realize, well, whenever I choose to do something, I'm choosing to realize some good, because there would be no point to acting. But I also realize I can choose to pursue some good in a manner that slights, as I said before, introduces into my will a diminishing of appreciation of some other good. Or I can choose to pursue a good in a way that does not introduce a privation in my will, that rather enhances my love of good. And it seems to me that distinction between the choices that enhance my love of good versus those choices that introduce into my will a diminishing of the love of good, that's where the basic moral principle is. And so it seems to me that we can have a sort of a two-step process at getting to the basic moral proposition that we ought to choose in line with a love for all of the basic goods in ourselves and in others. In that way, then, the kind of worry that some of our Neo-Aristotelian friends have about we do not like to attempt to deduce ought propositions from is propositions, for the very good reason that that's a logical fallacy, and we don't enjoy committing logical fallacies. We can avoid attempting to do that, to commit that logical fallacy, because we can, we've given a, there's an account there by which we can, by which the is to be propositions and then the moral ought propositions are understood as self-evidently true. Well, I throw that out there because Rabbi Novak and I were talking about that over breakfast a little bit, and I just throw that out there. Perhaps someone will be will return to that in question and answer period. In addition to this issue about whether my choice enhances my love of the good or introduces a or diminishes it, in addition to that, we are creatures and we are members of this large community, which is God's creation. God is the ruler of this community, and by creating us and giving us our nature and giving us reason, he has directed us toward the fulfillment of ourselves and of our neighbor. Therefore, a bad choice includes, even if the sinner does not explicitly advert to the fact, a substituting of one's own subjective preference for the wisdom that is manifested in God's order. God's order as inculcated in our nature and reason. To return to the analogy of the prince and the king, I think oftentimes sinners are like a person who really gets angered by the prince because the prince blocks some desire he has. And so the sinner is motivated to punch the prince or harm him in some way, not precisely in order to get revenge on the king, although that can happen also, but because the prince himself has in some way angered him. Still, by harming the prince, he does by implication show a lack of respect for or a lack of due regard for the king. It is true that someone may, and in many cases people do, explicitly hate God. Perhaps out of anger at God because of the limitations he has placed on one's unruly desires. But I do not think that every sin is necessarily an explicit hatred of God. Oftentimes it is indirect as a substitution of one's subjective preferences for God's objective and wise plan. The Proverbs text quoted by Rabbi Novak says, quote, "Whoever reviles the weakest one reviles his maker." Unquote. Of course, I accept that is true, but I do not think it means that a sinner reviles the weakest one because he first reviles God. At least that is not necessarily the case. It is more likely the reverse. He reviles God as a consequence of his reviling God's creature or God's child. The logical relationship between love or hatred of God's children on the one hand and love or hatred of God on the other is captured in St. John's first letter. There he says, quote, "If anyone says, 'I love God,' and hates his brother, he is a liar. For he who does not love his brother whom he has seen cannot love God whom he has not seen." Unquote. God has freely created, not for his own sake, but to communicate goodness to others. And he has created human persons in his own image and likeness. So the basic logic of the situation is as St. John expresses it. And I think Rabbi Novak agrees with his point. If you are or I love God, then we love our neighbor. That is a logical entailment. For to love God will involve cooperating with his plan. And his plan is to communicate goodness and fulfillment to his creatures, in particular to his rational creatures. Or, if you love someone, then you love those whom he loves. If you love the king, you will love, that is the desire, the true fulfillment of his children, or the prince and maybe the princesses. But then, by logical transposition, or by kind of condensed modus tollens argument, it follows that if you hate your neighbor, then you fail to love God. To love someone is to will that person's fulfillment. God is already fulfilled in himself independently of his creation. But in a way, we can will his fulfillment by willing, and that means also, of course, actually working for the fulfillment of his plan. His plan is to share his goodness, to communicate his goodness, especially to rational creatures. So to hate one's neighbor is to fail to love God, and is in a way indirectly to hate God, in that one's will is contrary to God's fulfillment, viewed in this broad sense as the fulfillment of his plan. But it need not be hating one's neighbor because one hates God. Since God has created beings really distinct from himself, who have real goodness in them, even though continually caused in them by God, that genuine goodness can ground a duty to pursue, promote, and respect them. And I think that suggests that the good is logically prior to the right. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll now have a few minutes here for a question and answer session. We have microphones at each side. If you have a question, please come up so we can hear you. And our tradition here is for a student to ask the first question. So students, whoever thought you might want to ask a question, this is your opportunity. So come up, ask away, and we'll have a few question and answer here. Nobody has any questions. All right. Yes, sir. Come on up, please.
Of moral reflection, discernment as, forget your exact terminology, but something to the effect of partnering with God in his creation and following in that pattern that he's given us. And given the discussion that ensued about the differences between obedience to commands and obligations versus just pursuit of the good, I was curious to both of you, really, would you say that God's commands in creation and subsequently through his revelation, that God gives us commands because of what is good, or that things are good because of God's commanding of them?
Famous Euthyphro question, you know, that was asked by Socrates in the early dialogue of Euthyphro. You know, is it holy because God loves it, or is it the God loves it because it's holy? And I would answer that something is good precisely not God has commanded it because it's good, but it is good because God has commanded it. Now, God has commanded it for very good reasons, and we can understand what those reasons are. So the commandment, thou shalt not kill, is commanded for a very good reason. Why? Because a human being created in the image of God is not to be harmed. So in that way, I think that we kind of get around that notion. But the problem that I have philosophically with this primacy of goods or the good is there is a residual Platonism in this. That somehow there is something called the good. And this has some kind of ontological status, even though in the school of thought of Brisset and Pindus and George, all of them have avoided, in fact, traditional Thomas is very critical of them for avoiding what is the metaphysical backing for these. And I understand why they adopted that strategy philosophically. But in that way, it means that in answer to Dr. Lee's question, is that it's not that God commands thou shalt not kill. The very presence of another human being, which is the image of God, the reflection of God, is something that is, so the presence of that person, not something called a good, but the presence of that person is something that makes a claim upon me. The minimal claim not to harm it, the maximal claim to love it. In fact, there's a discussion in the Talmud that asks the question, when one of the rabbis said, you shall love your neighbor as yourself, that's the most inclusive and the greatest command in the Torah. Another one said, no, that presupposes man is created in the image of God. In other words, because a human being is created in the image of God, therefore, and created by divine command, that person is lovable, and therefore, their very presence should elicit my love, because that is how God has made that the person lovable. But it's not even that God is good. I think there's a whole question there. And actually, I could argue, and I think that I can argue certainly in a context like this, so where the Bible is taken very seriously. You look at the Hebrew Bible, and you look at the term good used there, it is usually used adjectivally, adverbially. In other words, this has been done well. When God says what he sees created, God saw that it was good, it means God saw that it turned out well. That's why it's interesting in Genesis 1, the creation of man is not declared to be good. Why? Because the jury is still out. You have given freedom. Final judgment is not there. Everything else follows the plan. But you have been as a partner in God's creation. Therefore, we still want to see what you're going to come up with. That's what you're going to do before we can declare that's the case. I mean, this has been very much pointed out. But these divine commands are not irrational. We know divine commands are rational. I mean, they're not being ratio per se, as the Talmudists would say, rational in and of themselves, they're ratio per us. They're rational to us. In other words, and one in secular discourse, I try to do this in my book called The Sanctity of Human Life. I try to get the secular discourse, you don't have to have people accept your theological premises, even based on revelation, or even your theological premises on the existence of a creator God. You simply have to indicate that, yes, don't we want our own lives and the lives of others to be treated with a certain mysterious, that we should have a certain mysterious, treated as mysterious, and therefore at least exert a certain restraint. And this is the case, and I think that the best way to argue this has been alluded in one of the presentations today with people who are, I'm not militant type secularists who don't want to talk to them anyway, but I mean people who kind of, you know, don't have a particular religious commitment or whatever, is on the question of human rights. Because they know that human rights require a grounding that is more than simply a social entitlement. In fact, I see Professor Greg Elshin here today. She edited a book that I had a chapter in called Does Human Rights Need God? And it was a conference that we had at the University of Chicago. But the point there is yes, I think one could show that, but you don't have to, when you're dealing with it, just deal with the notion that human rights are not entitlements from the state. They have to come from somewhere else, and that's more than just positing them, as some of my working would say. And that way, it's the same thing. The human person, yes, I don't have to necessarily be aware or aware yet of the person as the image of God in the positive sense that I have a relationship with God, but that somehow or other, that human person is different from, and not to be treated like anything else. Of course, Peter Singer at Princeton thinks otherwise, but then you see how the moral discussion unravels and how many people who are otherwise secular are very unhappy with that kind of an approach, which doesn't respect human uniqueness, let alone human self.
I think some commands are there's some type of an arbitrariness in them. For example, Catholics are, I think, commanded not to eat meat on Fridays during Lent. And there's some degree of arbitrariness. And so the reason why it's good for me to abstain from meat tomorrow is because I've been commanded on that. Other commands are different. They are, there isn't that degree of arbitrariness in it. I think God, when God freely chose to create human beings, then at that point, he could not choose to create human beings and then not direct them to their real fulfillment. And so in choosing to create them at that very time, then he is choosing to direct them for the fulfillment, and he could not then go back and say to people, well, okay, you know, we're going to call off the commandment against killing human beings this week, or we're going to call off the commandment against adultery this week. Those things that are prohibited in the Ten Commandments, I think, are prohibited because they're in themselves wrong. They're consequent upon God's choice to create a human being. He did not both create a human being and then also make it good to choose to kill him. And the discussion about the Crusade ministry, that's the thing that we can follow up on. That. That's the first in a long time I've been accused of being a Platonist, and I like all Platonists are residual. Well, it's not the good, it's good, it's real good. Now, when you say, I like that, when you say the human person himself or herself makes a claim, now you're getting close to now you're coming around. I mean, it's that, and by the good, you know, the human person and the good of the human person are really not different. The good of the human person is really the full being, the being and full being of the person. I don't see the goodness of the human person as something different from the being of the human person. It's the being of the person viewed as fulfilled. But that's something we can continue on. But a lot more can be said on that. Maybe we follow up further with comments or questions.
I think we have time for one more question. Come up, please. Okay, talk loud. That's fine.
Okay. This is not really a major argument, but it seems to be suggestive as regards to this question about the relationship between the right and good. It seems to me that there's just some things that it wouldn't make sense for us to claim a right to. It makes no sense for me to talk about a right to have a punch in the nose or a right to have a plate of mud. And our concept of rights seems bound by the notion of what we can conceivably think of as beneficial to us. That seems to me to indicate and the priority of the good to the right. And that dependence doesn't seem to be present when we talk about the good. We can think of all sorts of things that's good for us. It's good for me to be alive, it's good for me to be healthy, it's good for me to be knowledgeable, well before we ever think in terms of the idea of us having rights to those things.
You want me to answer that?
I suspect I know what you're thinking.
Does work. As follows. I think one of the things that came out of Dr. Lee's presentation, of a presentation of the is-ought distinction, which also Elizabeth Anscombe in that great essay showed that we got to get over that or we're not going to have. Now, the way that the Professor George and the others in, you know, what really becomes a kind of a school of thought is that the is to be is what bridges something which is as a, and just, you know, a fact as distinct from an actual obligation and ought. In my way of thinking, the thing that bridges that are the fundamental claims that are made upon us. In other words, we come into the world both first others requiring us to do certain things, and then we learn how to make claims upon others. And that is a fact, it is an is, it's something that goes on, and yet it is not something that does not have certain moral consequences. In other words, whereas one cannot derive an ought from an is in that kind of dichotomy, one can infer an is from an ought. Wittgenstein does that very interestingly enough in the Philosophical Investigations. In other words, I learn what a tool is when somebody tells me to go and get it. And then I have to figure out what it is in order to know how to do what I've been asked to do with it. So therefore, in that sense of rights being claims, yes, I think that we are claimed even before we have any understanding of what is beneficial for us or anybody else.
Can I take a moment to weigh in on Professor Joel on this.
Well, thanks to both David, Rabbi Novak, and to Professor Lee for the presentation. And it's a very important subject. You notice it came up this morning as well with Professor Stoner's presentation and Professor Nallen. That is the relationship of our understanding of the good to our understanding of the right. Now, I'll bet a lot of students here are wondering, what on earth is this all about? Let me see if I can just sum it up in a way that is neutral as between the competing points of view here, and then I'll say a word about why I take the view that I take. And then I want to say another word about why I think it's very appealing to try to take the view that David takes. First, what's going on here? Well, when we talk about what's right or what's wrong, we talk about norms. We're interested in norms by which we can distinguish the two. And those norms are ordinarily categorical. Don't do that, that would be wrong. Do that because that's the right thing to do, and not to do it would be wrong. Right? When we talk about the good, we're talking about what is beneficial for a person or a community. What is for the fulfillment, the well-being of the community. Now, when we talk about the good, or goods, or human goods, we're talking about aspects of human well-being and fulfillment, aspects of human flourishing. What, in Dr. Martin Luther King said in his famous letter from Birmingham jail, what elevates the human person. And of course, the reverse of it, the bad, the evil, is what brings a person down. So what are the, when we inquire into the nature of the human good, we're trying to figure out in what respects can people flourish, be elevated, or decline. And we can identify them quite easily. We know that a life that's solitary, that doesn't involve being in community with other people, that doesn't involve friendship and family, is just that far forth impoverished. Now, there may be a reason that somebody might have that's valid for cutting himself off from society, a hermit monk for high spiritual reasons, but he's still giving up something. In return for whatever else he gets, there's something being given up there. But friendship, we know, is not the only aspect of human well-being or fulfillment or flourishing. We know that intellectual knowledge, considered not just as information, but as the mental activity of knowing, being alert and bright and engaged as opposed to being muddle-headed. We know that that is an aspect of our flourishing. We can flourish in respect of our intellectual life, or we can fail to flourish and be diminished, perhaps because we allow ourselves to fall into prejudice or sloth or something even worse, allow ourselves to be addicted to drugs or something like that. So friendship is an aspect of human well-being. Knowledge is an aspect of human well-being. There are many aspects of human well-being. Now, David's concerned, Rabbi Novak's concerned, that on my account there's still a residual Platonism there. Although, of course, I've explicitly, in many cases, denounced that kind of Platonism. What Rabbi Novak has in mind is this. The idea is that the good is detached from the actual substance of a human life. Platonic in the sense of the Platonic forms, that there's a form of the good, it's out there, this is a kind of, our own lives are kind of a pale imitation of it, and that's what there is. But on this issue, I come down squarely with Aristotle against Plato. The forms are inherent in the substance of the thing, so that what is the human good of friendship? It's the human good precisely as instantiated in my friendship with my friends Rabbi Novak and Professor Lee, my spousal relationship with my wife, my relationship with my children, my relationship with Dr. Dockery or my former student Micah Watson. That's where the good happens. That's the substance of the very thing, right? Same with knowledge. Same with skillful performance, aesthetic appreciation, the practice of virtue itself. Religion, in the sense of our aspirations and endeavors to understand who God is and to form a relationship with Him that is a proper relationship with our with our Maker. In all of those respects, we flourish or fail to flourish if we don't do it right. In our biological life, in our moral life, in our emotional life, in our spiritual life. So then the question simply becomes this. What is the relationship between the good, that is, the diverse, variegated aspects of human flourishing, and the right, moral norms that distinguish right from wrong? And this is important for this reason. You can have intelligible reasons for doing things that are morally bad. This is a complicated world. People don't just do bad things out of anger or irrational hatred and so forth. You can do something that will instantiate a benefit in you or me or our community, but in a way that's wicked from a moral point of view, that's excluded by the right. Best example, science. Think of what we could learn from science. Think of what people are proposing to learn, even today, from science conducted unethically. What they're after, for example, in embryo destructive research, what people who support that are after is a true good. Knowledge, and not simple knowledge, but knowledge that will actually lead to greater health, curing diseases, the mitigation of suffering, and so forth. That's an intelligible good. That's a real aspect of human well-being and fulfillment. But it's excluded by a moral norm. Now, where did that moral norm come from? Now, that I've got a thesis about. And I think here would be a point of difference that would be interesting to explore if we had more time between Rabbi Novak and myself. My thesis is that those moral norms that, for example, rule out even pursuing the true good of knowledge by means that involve injustices to other people, born or unborn, that norm, like all moral norms, comes as an implication of the integral directiveness of the human good considered in all of its diversity, of the variegated human good. That is, those norms reflect what we must do and not do if we're to have a full and open-hearted love of the human good, which is only to say, since I'm not a Platonist but rather an Aristotelian on this, which is only to say a full and open-hearted love of the human person made in the image and likeness of God. If you love the person, you will favor what's good for the person. You won't punch him in the nose. You won't give him a plate of mud. Those aren't for his good. You'll give him a plate of food. You'll tend to his needs. You'll love and care for him. So an open-hearted love of the good, the love of the good in its wholeness, is a love for persons, our brothers and sisters made in the image and likeness of God, possessing the literally awesome powers of reason and freedom, if only in some cases in a very early and inchoate form, as with the earliest stages of human life, or in some cases in a very badly diminished form as a result of infirmity or old age or retardation, still recognizing them as human beings whose interests, whose flourishing is to be favored. So in that way, my thesis is the good is logically prior to the right because it's the integral directiveness of the good that enables us to identify, that shapes the norms of morality, the right. Now, I think it's easy to conclude that there's another respect in which you could say the right is prior to the good for this reason. The right is ordinarily categorical. The good, because of its diversity, because there are so many aspects of human well-being and fulfillment that can be instantiated in so many ways by so many diverse activities, is ordinarily a matter of optional choice. Unless there's a moral norm that it happens to be in the territory, given the circumstances that you're in, that's directing you to do this and only this now. Unless that's the case, then you'd face what we ordinarily face throughout our entire lives, most days, including right now, which is a choice between morally legitimate possibilities, none of which is excluded by a categorical norm. You could be here, which you are, pursuing all of us together the good of knowledge, trying to enhance our understanding, improve our minds. But you're under no strict moral obligation to be here, except those of you who perhaps are assigned in class to be here. You could be taking care of an elderly relative. You could be visiting prisoners. You could be at prayer. There are lots of things you could do. So the actual force, ordinarily, of the claim that any particular good makes on us is weak by comparison with the very strong force of a moral norm when it's operative in the circumstances that we're in. So that can validate one sense in which you might say the right has priority over the good. But there's also another sense, because when we consider the respects in which we can flourish, we consider the human good in all its wholeness, notice the good of living a virtuous life itself is a good. In other words, living in line with the norms, the right, doing what's right, not what's wrong, is itself an aspect of our flourishing. So it not only guides us, helps to structure, it's architectonic in this way, structure our pursuit of the other goods. It is in itself an aspect of our well-being. And given that interesting quality of the specifically moral good, what I have elsewhere and my teacher John Finnis have called practical reasonableness, but it doesn't matter what you call it. It includes personal authenticity, includes integrity, but the key thing about it is that it is itself something that we flourish in respect of. Right? Now, given that, there's also a sense in which we can say it has a kind of priority, especially because it does structure our pursuit of all of the other goods. It's in itself a good in itself, not merely instrumentally, but intrinsically, and it structures, helps to structure the pursuit of all of the other goods. Now, we could say more about that with respect to the very interesting question that Keith Pavlicek has considered in very interesting ways of the good of religion and the architectonic role that faith plays. I'm going to say a bit about that tomorrow at the chapel service for anybody who's interested, because it's not just practical reasonableness that helps to shape our pursuit of the other goods. In the most important and profound sense, it's religion that does that, that establishes our vocation. It's our relationship with God in which our vocation is established, our call, what God wants us to do, and so forth. Okay, so I've lectured for long enough, and I want to thank again Rabbi Novak and Professor Lee for their wonderful paper.